Minisode 31 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before I begin today, I want to thank our sponsors. CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. Now today I spoke with Danielle DiMartino Booth, president of Money Strong LLC, former advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and author of one of my favorite books, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. And Mark Yusko, CEO and CIO of Morgan Creek Capital Management. Now today we jumped right into topics and began our discussion with their thoughts on Fed Chair Powell and the job he's done thus far. Next I asked them what we should be watching to predict what the Fed will do with interest rates. We chatted about yield curves, the possible unwinding of the risk parity trade, gold, the US dollar, central banks, blockchain technology, and crypto assets. Now, in this episode, we had a little issue with the sound, so I apologize for that. But the content was so good, you probably won't even notice. As usual, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Danielle, Mark, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to speak to the two of you. Now, I hit Twitter up for some questions for you guys, and we got a huge response. So thank you to everyone on Twitter for responding. But I also have several questions for you guys. So I'm just going to jump right into it today. And I want to begin with you, Danielle. I want to talk about Powell. I know it's only been a very short time, but I want to know, what are your thoughts on him and the job he's done thus far?
Well, I give him a thumbs up. I give him an A+ so far. Of course, on planet Earth, he really has not been tested. If you consider where markets are, he had a volatility test that would have scared Greenspan, Bernanke, or Yellen into producing some emergency statement that the Federal Reserve was there to backstop markets, and he didn't. He didn't blink. His comments have been very forthright. He took 43 of his 60 minutes for his first press conference. And he's not wasting anybody's time, including his own. So, the only thing that I question is his apparently being in full support of bringing John Williams in to head the New York Fed. I'm scratching my head on that one, mainly because John Williams has said himself, I don't have a Bloomberg machine on my desk. The last I checked, the head of the New York Fed is the second most powerful individual in the entire system. They're the vice chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee. They have a permanent vote. Their duty is to regulate the most complex financial system in the world that's on that little 18-by-3-mile island. And they should have a little appreciation, enough appreciation for the markets that they have a Bloomberg terminal on their desk. I'm sure he's being schooled in everything, but I do question that one decision by Powell because I understand, again, he was fully supportive.
Mark, how about you? What do you think about Powell and the job he's done thus far?
Yeah, I guess I agree he gets an A+ for showing up to school on time. But I don't think there's really anything that we can judge other than he, as Danielle said, he wasn't overly reactive as our previous Fed chairs have been every time there was a boogeyman scare on volatility in the markets. But I don't think we have enough data to decide. I completely agree with Danielle on this appointment of Williams. I scratch my head. I shake my head. Anything I can do to voice or pledge a disapproval. I just think that the idea of non-financial people and non-real world experienced people being in charge of financial institutions is suspect at best and comical at worst.
Yeah, I mean, from a trader standpoint, the best thing I could say about Powell thus far, because I know it's been such a short time, is exactly what Danielle mentioned right out of the gates, was that he was tested with some volatility and he didn't make any emergency statements. So for me, I look at it and go, that's the best thing from a trader's perspective that I could ask for, is that we don't want them commenting every time the market moves. It's just too much. I mean, we talked about this, actually, all three of us, not together, but separately when you were on the show before. You know, we wanted the Fed to be transparent, but I think they've gotten far too transparent, and it's made the job for traders a lot tougher because Fed speak every day. I want to talk a little bit more about predicting the Fed and Powell and interest rates, like going forward. What data points, we'll go back to Danielle, should we be watching to see if we get one or two, or even a lot of people saying even possibly three more rate hikes this year? So Danielle, what should we be focusing on to kind of read the tea leaves to see what Powell will do?
Well, Anthony, the question is going to be a lot easier for your listeners in particular, because Jay Powell founded the Industrials Group when he was with the Carlyle. So he's in constant contact with CEOs, CFOs across the industrial spectrum. He will be paying attention to what we will be paying attention to in the weeks to come, and that is the earnings reports. And if there are other echoes that input costs and rising wages and the need to pay overtime are starting to eat into margins, then that will continue to validate Powell's concerns that inflation, at least in the medium term, is a real problem for this economy. In other words, license to continue on and do three more rate hikes this year. I'll point out something very, very interesting that we saw in the release of the Fed minutes, and that is that not one single member of the Federal Open Market Committee, both voting and non-voting, voiced concerns that there were downside risks to inflation. Not a single voting and non-voting member. That's the first time that that's happened since 2011, when record keeping began. There is a consensus that there is at least, and again, in the medium term, upside risk to inflation.
You know, Mark, I always like picking your brain about execution, and hearing what Danielle just mentioned about what we should be watching for and what the Fed may do. Are you changing anything in the way that you're executing, or is it steady as she goes and you're not too worried about the Fed? You're looking at the big picture anyway. I guess I'm just trying to figure out from you, looking at the landscape with this new Fed chair, has it changed anything for you in how you're executing any trades?
Yeah, definitely. A great point and great question. Yellen was an ultra dove. In fact, if there was anything even more soft than a dove, then we have to come up with that. She makes doves look hawkish. So a change from her was a reason, I think, to be more hedged with a D. And I think Powell comes in with a little bit of, at least a little bit of real world acknowledgement that we have to let the markets eventually function. You know, on short-term interest rates, right? I mean, for 100 years, Fed rate has approximated inflation, and that just hasn't been the case for the last 6 or 7 years. And we've been holding these extraordinary liquid measures to levels just like in the financial crisis. I mean, all the jawboning about tightness and restrictive policy and QT is just a joke. There hasn't been any real restriction of liquidity in the marketplace, and so we do think that he will be a little more serious about it, and therefore we have taken up our hedges in portfolios across the board, and that served us well as markets actually down a little bit for the year, and there are a lot of stocks that are down a lot. And so our hedged guys have been making lots of money on the short side in companies that are finally waking up to say, oh, maybe it's not going to be extend and pretend forever.
Okay, I want to go back to Danielle. Danielle, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the yield curves. I know that you watch them, and as we sit, I think that like the 530 sitting just above 30 basis points, and the 210 is somewhere around 43 basis points. They continue to flatten, so I'm wondering what you think about that. And I'm also wondering what you think that the FOMC is thinking when they see these yield curves flattening the way they have been.
Well, you know, Powell said it in his press conference. He is paying attention to the yield curve. So you know, they're not completely blind to it. John Williams gave a speech in Spain today where he said he anticipates there being an easy glide path to getting the Fed funds rate to 3% by the end of 2019. And again, you have to ask yourself, what planet is this man on? Why does he think that he can thread that needle if he's talking about the Fed funds rate itself being above the 10-year yield as things stand? And that means that Fed policymakers believe that they can generate some upside in yields on the long end of the curve. I think that with $237 trillion and counting of global debt levels, that the yield curve is communicating to us loud and clear that the last thing that the world economy and the overabundance of debt that's been created since the financial crisis, the last thing it can handle is higher long-term interest rates.
Mark, I go back to you again for the execution side of things. Getting the insight from Danielle and what the Fed is looking at and with this yield curve flattening, what do you make of it? What do you think about this flattening yield curve? And once again, what decisions are you making or changing based upon a flattening yield curve?
Yeah, look, I think the yield curve is a great indicator of the belief in the Fed's activities, whether the market believes that the Fed is achieving its goals, whether it's making a policy mistake. And I think you can hear it screaming loudly and clearly that every time they've raised short-term rates, the yield curve doesn't steepen. It actually gets more flat. And we're on the verge, as Danielle just mentioned, of pushing to an inverted curve, which would push us into recession, which I actually think is a good thing. I mean, I have a hashtag, you know, hashtag make recessions great again. We need recessions. We need to shut down the bad businesses that have been extended credit like zombies and the zombie apocalypse is coming. So if you look at the short end of the curve, it's been spiking. The long end of the curve has actually been falling slightly. So we're getting flatter and flatter and flatter. And I think it's entirely unlikely that long-term rates are going to rise. In fact, one of our big surprises and our Morgan Creek surprises this year is that, you know, you should, like Willy Wonka said, you should never, never doubt what no one is sure about. And everyone on the planet is sure interest rates are going to rise. We actually think long-term rates are going to fall, and you might want to be buying long-term treasuries here.
Mark, I want to stick with you just for a second, if I can here, please. You just mentioned that you think that long-term rates are probably going to go lower, not higher. But I want to talk to you a little bit about the possibility of the unwinding of the risk parity trade, something that I've been keeping an eye on over the past year and a half. And this year, we actually saw a short period of time where we did see bonds, treasuries, and equities go down at the same time. So I'm just wondering, even though you think that long-term rates are going to go down, are you watching the risk parity trade? Is it something you're keeping an eye on, the possibility of it unwinding?
Sure. And, you know, it's funny. You know, I love following Cliff Asness on Twitter, you know, because anytime the market moves down, everybody blames risk parity and Cliff for crashing the world. And, you know, what's amazing is, yeah, there was a couple week period where both bonds and stocks fell. And risk parity's done. It's going to have to unwind. And Cliff and Bridgewater and everybody's going to be unwinding their big giant portfolios since the end of the world. But if you look at total debt on a global basis, you look at the amount of debt that's being created every day with deficit spending and the stupidity of tax reform, as I like to call it, I think that there's very little chance that we're going to have this big increase in interest rates and that we're going to unwind all of the risk parity trade. So while I don't have a very sanguine view for equities, if short rates rise, I do have a differentiated view on long-term treasuries. I think the risk parity will be okay. They won't be great like they have been, but they'll be okay.
I'm actually going to add something. I'm going to jump in there on that, even though I don't normally wear a trader hat, but I've certainly been following this very closely. John Authors in the Financial Times over the weekend wrote a column that basically said, for anybody who thinks that the fangs have fallen out of bed, they clearly don't have a long-term chart on hand. And I was actually going back and forth with Christopher Cole of Artemis last week. And, you know, he's been studying this risk parity trade and volatility for a very long time now. And his comment to me was what was remarkable in February's trading was not the rise in volatility per se. It was how quickly liquidity evaporated. And that is what he has been tracking the most closely. And the reason he and I started chatting back and forth last week is I said, I'm not following the 10-year as closely anymore as I am the 2-year, because I think that it could be the trigger point to set the MOVE index off. The MOVE index is VIX's sister in the fixed income market. And we have seen treasury and bond market volatility completely crash to record lows, the same way we had seen the VIX crash to record lows last year. I'm much more concerned for the time that comes when bond market volatility picks up. And I think that the moves we've seen in LIBOR, the moves that we've seen this year in the 2-year, are much more indicative of the potential for a liquidity hiccup in the bond market than the 10-year is.
All right, I want to go to some of the Twitter questions here. Let's stay on interest rates. You know, quicker answers for these Twitter questions. We'll stay with you, Danielle. How many hikes this year? How many hikes next year?
I say 2 hikes this year, even though Powell would like to do 3, but he will not continue to hike into recession. So I say 2 and done.
Mark?
Yeah, they say great minds think alike. So I'm going to echo that. I think 2, and by early 2019, we're going to have that recession that's been long overdue, and you can't hike into that. So I think 2 and done is right.
Next one's on gold. Thoughts on it, and are either of you long it? And if so, what percentage of portfolio? Stay with Mark.
Yeah, look, I think gold has a place in everyone's portfolio. For a small percentage, you know, like a 1-2%. Look, it's been called the barbarous relic. It's been called worthless. But at the end of the day, it is the one asset that for 5,000 years has protected your wealth against the ravages of inflation. And in a really difficult equity unwinding, which I do think is likely here over the next 12-ish months or so, particularly with the fangs, as Danielle said, they haven't even turned over the covers, let alone fallen out of bed. When they fall, they're going down a long, long way. And so that, I think, could happen. And gold in that environment does preserve capital quite nicely, and the relative purchasing power goes up a lot. So you kind of hold gold and cash into the equity correction, and then you sell off the gold and cash and buy the depressed assets after they fall.
You know, I would just add one thing, and that is that a recent study has come out that gold has outperformed in inflationary and deflationary times. As a reformed former central banker who still has PTSD, what I can tell you is that gold is the only safe haven, as Mark just said, when correlations line up to a perfect number one. It is the only place to hide. So it's definitely wise to have a portion of your portfolio allocated to and to increase that as it's apparent that riskier assets are headed downwards.
Hey, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. Okay, next question is, I think, more towards Marx. Is given the current state of the U.S. dollar, what are your recommendations for U.S. institutional and separately U.S. retail investors?
Yeah, look, I've been bearish on the dollar since the Fed started hiking. You know, history tells us that the dollar peaked after the second hike, and that was a long time ago. So, and I actually think even further that the king dollar has been dethroned. I think the days of the petrodollar are over. We're going to move toward the petro-yuan. And China is playing a whole different game to move longer term toward moving from being a world reserve currency to the world reserve currency. That's not going to happen overnight. We're talking decade-ish. But in the short run, I think as an investor, you want to be short the dollar. There are a lot of ways you can do that in the the ETF markets and in the futures markets. But I don't think it's going to be a big, giant move. You know, we had a 10, 11% move last year. I think this year is going to be a little less. And I think there is one risk that you could have a short-term dollar kind of oversold rally before secular decline really kicks in. And that's going to be everything from, you know, a Trump tweet to who knows what. But longer term, we think the dollar on the DXY is headed for to 80 by the end of this year, into the 70s the following year.
Okay, Danielle, this one's more towards you. Do you think that a next round of major equity volatility and price pressure could dislodge the narrative of the central bank put, that central bankers will can lose control of a systemic mirage of their creation? Why has the Fed divergence from ECB BOJ policy not created upheaval yet? And will it?
Look, so the answer that I tweeted out to that was that we're not net negative with quantitative tightening. In other words, the Bank of Japan is inadvertently, and against its very will, it is in a tightening mode because of the way it conducted easing. Obviously, the ECB is set to be finished by the end of September with its tapering in total, and our run rate will be up at a much higher level. We'll do $420 billion of QT by the end of the year. But again, you don't turn into a net negative until later on this year. And I think that one of the sources of volatility this year has been quantitative tightening, because you're reducing QE globally from $2 trillion to $1 trillion in 2018, and markets don't like it one bit. The patient wants their methadone back, and they want the full dose. So I think that the markets will clue in once the aggregate QT figure gets a little bit bigger towards the fall.
All right, Mark.
Yeah, Anthony, I want to jump in on that one too. That everybody talks about this central bank put, and I just think it's kind of comical. You know, 85% of puts expire worthless, as have all the previous Fed puts. The Greenspan put expired worthless in 2000 to 2002. The market fell 56% peak to trough. The Bernanke put expired worthless in 2007-08 and into first quarter 2009. And, you know, what was the Yellen put, now the Powell put, is going to expire worthless too. So this idea that somehow central banks can repeal the law of gravity is just silly. Eventually, cycles turn, central banks tighten, they get rid of excess liquidity, and markets fall.
So, yeah. Anthony, I'm going to add 2 seconds to that. And that is that the top two quintiles of income earners in the United States account for 39% of consumption. Once we see a stock market decline and a bond portfolio decline start to tame spending in this country, Powell will react. He's just got a much, much, much different strike price than any of his predecessors would have.
Next question that I have, this is probably for both of you as well, is their current thoughts on the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, implications for maintaining U.S. dollar status. If U.S. dollar is to be replaced, would it be a multi-step replacement or just a gradual takeaway market share? Also, when crypto may play a legitimate part, don't think it's mature enough yet, but your guys' thoughts. We'll start with you, Mark.
Look, everyone knows my view on King Dollar being dethroned, that it's in a secular decline, that we're heading toward a multipolar world. I think you're going to see first this multipolar kind of movement more towards an SDR kind of platform. You know, the renminbi is now going to play a role. Now they have to open up their markets more fully, and they will. But you're going to see more increase in electronic payments like M-Pesa in Africa. Crypto is coming. Look, I have a huge positive view on what's going to happen in the crypto markets over the coming decades. I think we're moving toward the Bitcoin standard, away from the dollar standard. Again, that's not tomorrow or even next year, but it's over a period of many years. But we're just getting warmed up.
Danielle?
I'm a historian when it comes to reserve currency status, and I have 3 sons. So all of my children, since they're 4 years old, have been forced to take Mandarin because it's my ultimate insurance plan to have them working at the State Department decoding rather than on the front lines. And that is just, that is an innate fear that at some point we lose the reserve currency status the way historically it has always occurred, which is currency wars lead to hot wars. So that being said, it's just probably scared the hell out of you. As far as cryptos go, I do appreciate Randy Quarles and Jay Powell's comments that the United States will only delve into a federal FedCoin type of framework on an anonymous basis equal to that of a cash exchange today. That is one of the wisest things that I think both of them have said. Ken Rogoff and every other Keynesian dub would beg to differ and would prefer to monitor the use of cryptocurrencies. But I think that crypto is going to be elevated and escalated in our economy in particular as a matter of national security, because China, Venezuela, and Russia are already deep into establishing their own sovereign cryptocurrencies. And we know what those three countries have in common.
Quick follow-up on the crypto assets.
No question.
Quick follow-up on the crypto assets for you, Mark. And I am very bullish blockchain technology. But the one question, I've actually asked you this on Twitter, so I just want to ask you this again on the show. Can someone be bullish blockchain technology the way that I am? Like I said, I'm very bullish of it. I think it's going to be huge. But not bullish of the price of cryptos, because as much as I am a believer that blockchain will continue to grow and probably more rapidly than I think most people think, I'm not as certain about the price of Bitcoin and these other cryptos keeping pace with the growth and the use of blockchain technology.
So the short answer is no, you can't be bullish blockchain and not be bullish crypto. Now, the longer, and but I'll try to keep it shorter, is you don't have to pick one, but crypto is the fuel. So cryptocurrency is the fuel that makes blockchain possible. Blockchain technology can take many, many forms, and this could do many, many things, and there's not a business model on the planet that isn't going to be disrupted by blockchain technology. But crypto and all its use cases, from store of value to medium of exchange to utility tokens, and ultimately the big one, which is security tokens. So essentially think of it this way, is we are going from the era of paper ownership, okay, that started in the 1700s and continues on to today, to electronic ownership, where we have CUSIPs that represent those paper shares, but we're going to full-on digital ownership. And everything of value, every asset of value in the world is going to get tokenized, and it's going to be a massive transition. And cryptocurrencies are the way you enable those transactions to occur. So you don't have to pick any one. Now, I actually pick Bitcoin as the king, Ethereum as the crown prince, and then you got all the other princes that hate each other. And many and many of those are going to go away, many of the altcoins and SH coins, as they call them affectionately. But I don't think you can be bullish blockchain without being bullish on crypto as a class, because of the way it interacts. And it's like when people say, well, I like blockchain, but I hate Bitcoin. You can't. Bitcoin is a blockchain. Bitcoin is the reason blockchain is emerging as strongly as it is. So longer conversation for another day, but happy to have it.
Last question for today, guys.
I mean, The only thing I will add is Mark is absolutely dead on that if not for Bitcoin, there certainly would not be a cottage industry of firms exploring ways to exploit the blockchain. Bitcoin had to come first.
Final question for today, guys. Everyone wants to know your five-year outlooks. Based on the current environment, what do you see happening the next 5 years, 30 seconds or less? Mark, we'll go with you first.
Well, you got to say five-year outlook on what? So let's go very quickly. So I think emerging market equities, five-year outlook's really good. The developed market equities, particularly Europe, Japan, and the U.S., less good. U.S., the worst of those. And certain companies like the FANGs, I think, are going to do really, really poorly. On the bond market, I think we're going to be stuck in this no man's land and not a lot of there. You can look at the 10-year yield at 2-point-something. That's what you're going to make. So then when you think about other assets like real assets, I think assets relative to financial assets never been cheaper. So it's time to get real. And then crypto, I think, is going to beat it all. And I think you're going to do quite well owning crypto over the next 5 years.
Danielle?
So I worry the most over the next 5 years about this tremendous buildup that we've seen in the bond market. It is what I follow the absolute most closely. I think that that Mario Draghi waking up one day to realize he was holding a junk bond is just the tip of the iceberg. And I think the quote-unquote safe asset that investors perceive to be their bond holdings is going to be upended in the years that come. And that is what I would be absolutely following the most closely, because the bond market is so much bigger than the stock market. You know, $21 trillion of global QE equates to about 44% of global GDP. The unwind of this experiment is going to be absolutely historic in nature. And one of the areas that I see as being harmed the most is commercial real estate in the United States. We have an overabundance of it, and it is as overpriced as it has ever been, not just here, but also globally. So I think that people with dry powder are going to be able to come in and buy up severely distressed assets, but it's not going to be a pretty pathway to get from A to B.
Excellent insight today, guys. Well, we'll start with you, Danielle. Where can people find you on Twitter and a website to check out?
I'm not quite as exciting because I don't employ gracias as much as Mark does, but come find me at DeMartino Booth. That's all one big word. That's the same as my website, demartinobooth.com. I publish every Wednesday, and it's never boring.
Mark?
All right. So I'm easy to find at Mark Yusko, MarkYusko. And we're at Morgan Creek Cap, AP.com. No at there, just MorganCreekCap.com. And gracias for having me on the show. There I am with the gracias again. Because unlike unlike Danielle's kids taking Mandarin, my little guy is who's seven, is fluent in Espanol because his babysitter speaks solamente Espanol and won't let him off the hook. So he's pretty good, and I'm trying to catch up.
Well, you guys are fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show again. It's always great to hear from the two of you. Thank you so much again.
All right, take
care.
Thank
you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.